We are going to watch about a 45-minute video called The House We Live In that's going to give some context of history of race and racism in the United States. It's going to begin in the late 19th, early 20th century and then trace a few different patterns. It's a it's part of a larger series of videos produced by California Newsreel. If you find this to be interesting, just Google California Newsreel and you'll find a whole bunch of other similar videos that are very helpful. It's going to give some historical perspective and some economic perspective. Once the video's done, we're going to just have a chance for an extended Q&A conversation. I think Michael and Brenda are going to come up, and like you and I and Gino will be up here. So if you have questions or thoughts from what we've done so far, maybe make a little note of those. If you have questions or thoughts as we're watching the video, make a note of that, and then we'll end with a really long, We'll end with, you know, a good chance for some conversation. So this is called The House We Live In.
European ethnics become fully white, and thus fully American. By 1910, a new term was entering popular culture to describe the transformation of Europeans. The phrase came from the title of a Broadway play by Israel Zangwill. God, said Zangwill, would melt down the races of Europe into a single pure essence, out of which he would mold Americans.
So when the Irish, when Germans, when Italians were coming and they didn't speak the language, they didn't know the culture, the idea was they will assimilate into Americanhood. They will become American, which in the American tradition has meant white American. But that melting pot never included people of color. Blacks, Chinese, Puerto Ricans, etc., could not melt into the pot. They could be used as wood to produce the fire for the pot, but they could not be used as material to be melted into the pot.
Whiteness was key to citizenship. In 1790, Congress had passed an act declaring that only free white immigrants could become naturalized citizens. After the Civil War, naturalization was extended to persons of African descent as well. But it was the white citizen who had clear access to the vote, sat on juries, was elected to public office, and had better jobs. Whiteness was not simply a matter of skin color. To be white was to gain the full rewards of American citizenship.
In order to be a naturalized citizen in this country, you had to be categorized as white or black. And almost everybody who tried to naturalize, all but I think one case that went to the Supreme Court, all of them were people trying to be categorized as white. So the court had to make decisions about who was white and who was not.
Courts and legislators had long been in the business of conferring racial identities. In the South, to enforce Jim Crow segregation and laws against mixed marriages, courts had to first determine who was black under law.
And here's where it really gets interesting. You got some places, for example, Virginia. Virginia law defined a black person as a person with 1/16th African ancestry. Now, Florida defined a black person as a person with 1/8th African ancestry. Now, Alabama said, you're black if you got any black ancestry, any African ancestry at all. But you know what this means? You can walk across a state line and literally, legally change race. Now, what does race mean under those circumstances? You give me the power, I can make you any race I want you to be, because it is a social, political construction.
In 1909, American courts had that power. That year, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Massachusetts ruled that Armenians, often classified as Asiatic Turks, were legally white. If Armenians could be designated white, what of the other so-called Asiatic races? Filipinos, Syrians, the Japanese. Could they also petition successfully to be designated white by the courts and thus become Americans? In 1922, when Japanese businessman Takao Ozawa petitioned the Supreme Court for naturalization, many in the Japanese community believed his was the perfect test case.
Takao Ozawa came from Japan, went to the University of California at Berkeley for a few years, then moved to Hawaii where he had a family, and he applied to become a naturalized citizen in 1915.
My father wrote his own brief and everything, and he was really devoted. He wanted to become an American citizen, and nothing would stop him. He was determined.
Japanese growers in California watched Ozawa's case closely. By 1920, a series of alien land acts prohibited many non-citizens from owning or leasing land. Without a legal designation of whiteness to make them citizens, Japanese immigrants could not have the full protection of American law, no matter how long they lived in the country. In his brief, Ozawa argued that his skin was as white as any so-called Caucasian, if not whiter. But he made a much more important second argument.
But a second argument was that race shouldn't matter for citizenship. What really mattered was a person's beliefs.
My honesty and industriousness are well known among my Japanese and American friends. In name, Benedict Arnold was an American, but at heart he was a traitor. In name, I am not an American. But at heart, I am a true American.
The articles would come out in the paper. I thought, ooh, what did he do? You know, I thought only bad things came out in the paper, and I was kind of ashamed, you know, when I was a child. And it was just the way we were brought up. I didn't have any Oriental friends. My neighbors were all Caucasian, and so he was so determined to get us, well, when the time came, to be American citizens.
The Supreme Court ruled that Ozawa could not be a citizen. They said he was not white within the meaning of the statute and therefore not eligible to citizenship. And the court said, well, he's not white because he's not Caucasian, and Caucasians are whites. He did everything right. He learned English. He had a lifestyle that was American. He went to Christian church on Sunday. He dressed as a Westerner. He brought up his children as Americans. He did everything he was supposed to do. And yet he's told that he can't be a citizen because he's not white.
The court ruled that according to the best known science, Ozawa was not Caucasian, but of the Mongolian race. But the court would not be bound by science in policing the boundaries of whiteness. Only 3 months after Ozawa, the court took up the case of Bhagat Singh Thind, a South Asian immigrant and U.S. Army veteran who petitioned for citizenship on the grounds that Indians were of the Aryan or Caucasian race, and therefore white.
And he makes the scientific argument, having learned something actually from the Ozawa case, that he is Caucasian. He gets scientific authority to speak on his behalf, that in fact South Asians are included in the Caucasian race.
So here the court was in a bind because they were presented with so-called scientific evidence that Indians were Caucasian. And the court solved this problem by saying that it didn't matter what science said, so-called science. They actually said white is not something that can be scientifically determined, but white is something that is subjectively understood by who they called the common person, the common man.
It may be true, reasoned the court, that the blonde Scandinavian and the brown Hindu have a common ancestor in the dim reaches of antiquity. But the average man knows perfectly well that there are unmistakable and profound differences between them today. The same court that used science to determine whiteness in Ozawa 3 months before now refuted its own reasoning in Thind. Thind might well be Caucasian, the High Court said, but he was not white. The justices never said what whiteness was, only what it wasn't. Their implied logic was a circular one. Whiteness was what the common white man said it was.
The court often decided who was white and who wasn't based on whether they just felt that the person would politically fit well into the kind of society that we were trying to build. And sometimes it was pretty explicit that this is what the court was doing.
There was widespread racial views that Asians were undesirable, that they threatened to contaminate the American society. Basically, that Asians are too different, that they can't ever really become like the rest of us.
The consequences of the unanimous verdict in U.S. versus Thind were catastrophic for the Indian community. South Asians who had naturalized before the verdict were stripped of their citizenship and property. Vaishno Das Begay was a successful merchant who fled British tyranny in India to raise his family in a free country. After his American citizenship was revoked, he took his own life. He left a suicide note for his family and another for the public. But now they come and say to me, I am no longer an American citizen. What have I made of myself and my children? We cannot exercise our rights. We cannot leave this country. Humility and insults, blockades this way, and bridges burned behind. For the Japanese community, the verdicts in the Ozawa and Thind cases were equally devastating. Now, as aliens ineligible for citizenship, many growers were unable to purchase or even lease land to stay in business. Thousands of acres were seized from Japanese immigrants and sold to white farmers. By the time the racial requirement for naturalization was finally removed in 1952, Takao Ozawa was long dead.
The notion that Asians are racially unassimilable and that they're ineligible to citizenship because of their race is something that I think has had a real enduring effect. The fact that they were seen as non-American enabled many Americans to see them as the enemy and to strip them totally of their civil liberties and to put them in internment camps during World War II. The legacy of this idea is that even those who are third or fourth generation Asian Americans are still perceived as foreigners.
In 1924, Congress passed the Johnson-Reed Immigration Act, which effectively banned Asian immigration until 1965. Johnson Reed also cut immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe to a trickle. It was a time when hundreds of thousands of GIs came home ready to start families, but had no place to live.
Living space was at a premium. When in the Bronx, they tried building Quonset huts, and they turned to slums. All the Quonset huts had disintegrated. There were two families sharing a hut. One family at one end, one family at the other, and before you know it, they were awful.
FHA came to the rescue by insuring long-term, low-monthly payment mortgage loans.
Veterans needed homes for families. They turned to a revolutionary New Deal housing program. It would racialize housing, wealth, and opportunity for decades in ways few could have imagined.
In the 1930s, the federal government created the Federal Housing Administration, whose job it was to provide loans, or the backing for loans, to average Americans so they could purchase a home.
Due to the stimulation of the National Housing Act, from every section of the country come reports of vastly...
In order to purchase a house in America prior to 1930s, you had to pay 50% of the sales price up front. The new terms of purchasing a home was that you put 10% or 20% down, and the bank financed 80% of it, not over 5 years, but over 30 years, at relatively low rates. This opened up the opportunities for Americans to own homes like ever before. The average person could own that home.
If these terms sound familiar, they should, because this is essentially the same financing scheme that allows most Americans to own their homes today. Federal programs and banks sank millions into the home construction industry. Their message to veterans: you can afford a new home. Buy a new home now. On the outskirts of Baltimore, Memphis, Chicago, Los Angeles, Denver, and other cities, brand new communities sprang up. One of the most famous was a Long Island potato field transformed into 17,000 new homes. It was called Levittown. Tax dollars helped make the single-family home a mass-produced consumer item. The American dream had a new name: suburbia.
You have to remember, the people who came here in 1947, 1948 were young ex-GIs whose uppermost concern was taking advantage of the GI Bill and making things better for themselves.
Before moving to Levittown, Herb Callisman and his wife Doris lived in a cramped attic apartment in New York City.
And when we began to look for an apartment, we found that the apartments were $100, $125, $150 a month. I know that's unbelievable today, but it was too expensive for us. And out here in Levittown, the mortgage payments were $65 a month.
Your kitchen dazzles every eye.
A brand new sink, a built-in oven, a new refrigerator, and a...
If you were buying a Levitt home in 1947, 48, 49, 50, and 51, you would get... This would be your kitchen. You would get a GE stove, GE refrigerator, and a Bendix wash machine. It would be part of the real estate.
We came to Levittown and we found the model house, and we walked in and we looked around, and of course, in the eyes of a young man who was raised in the ghetto, so to speak, it was an interesting experience, interesting lifestyle. seeing all the new modern conveniences. Very fascinating.
Eugene Burnett came home with almost a million other black GIs. They had fought for the country in segregated ranks. They returned hoping for equality and the American dream. For many, that dream was a new home for little money down and some of the easiest credit terms in history.
I went up to the salesman. We're interested in your home. We're interested in buying one. And what is the procedure? Is there an application to be filled out? So forth. So he looked at me, looked around, and he said to me, he says, listen, it's not me, but the owners of this development have not as yet decided to sell these homes to Negroes.
It was as though it wasn't real. You can't imagine. But for someone to come out and actually tell you that they can't sell to you. You know, I was really on an up. Man, look at this house. Can you imagine having this? And then for them to tell me because of the color of my skin, I can't be a part of it.
The FHA underwriters warned that the presence of even one or two non-white families could undermine real estate values in the new suburbs. These government guidelines were widely adopted by private industry. Race had long played a role in local real estate practices. Starting in the 1930s, government officials institutionalized the national appraisal system, where race was as much a factor in real estate assessment as the condition of the property. Using this scheme, federal investigators evaluated 239 cities across the country for financial risk.
So that those communities that were all white, suburban, and far away from minority areas, they received the highest rating, and that was the color green. Those communities that were all minority or in the process of changing, they got the lowest rating, and the color red. They were redlined. As a consequence, most of the mortgages went to suburbanizing America, and it suburbanized it racially.
The racial logic adopts the principle that an integrated neighborhood is a bad risk, is a financial risk, that an integrated neighborhood is likely to be an unstable neighborhood, unstable socially, but therefore also unstable economically.
When the white residents of 8 Mile Road in Detroit were told they were too close to a black neighborhood to qualify for a positive FHA rating, they built this 6-foot wall between themselves and their black neighbors. Once the wall went up, mortgages on the white properties were approved. Between 1934 and 1962, the federal government underwrote $120 billion in new housing. Less than 2% went to non-whites.
I can understand an individual, depending on his environment or his family or whatever, being racist, but for your country to sanction it, give him tools to do that, there's something deadly wrong there.
I think we had the golden chance after World War II, and we flubbed it. Because here we had a GI Bill that was that was available to everybody. But in a way, they didn't make it available to everybody. And that was a golden opportunity in this country, and we missed it. We really missed it.
Fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
In 1968, President Johnson signed the Fair Housing Act. For the first time, racial language was removed from federal housing policy. Non-white families began moving into traditionally white communities in numbers.
We lived in an apartment, a two-family house in Queens, and when we came here, it was the first time we had bought a house, and I was looking for everything in the storybooks.
The Frisbees moved from Queens to suburban Roosevelt, only a few miles from Levittown. Like the Frisbees, many non-white families would discover the economic value of race in the real estate market. They watched as their homes and neighborhoods in suburbia declined precisely because they had moved into them.
When I moved into a neighborhood, I thought it would stay intact the way it was. On the street that I moved on when I moved there, it was predominantly white. Within 2 years, it was predominantly black.
It was called blockbusting. Real estate agents preyed on the racial fears of white homeowners to get them to sell their homes quickly for less than market value. The homes were resold to non-whites at inflated prices.
Well, they would say, you know, we're having black people move in. Now, I will give you cash if you want to sell me your house. Do you want to stay with black people next door to you? And that's the way it went on. And as Bunny said, a lot of the people just said, yes, I'll take the money and run. And that's the start of the white people leaving.
As more black and Latino families moved to Roosevelt, real estate became more and more depressed, just as the FHA had predicted. But why?
I have an idea my house is probably worth around $120 in this town. But what it would be worth in Wantagh, Garden City, or some other place, probably around $200,000 or better. Now you're talking about $80,000. You said to me one time about why do people dislike the blacks? Well, money-wise, there's a reason. Not that you dislike the blacks so much, but you dislike what happens when a community turns from white to black.
It wasn't African Americans moving in that caused housing values to go down in Roosevelt and other neighborhoods. It was whites leaving.
When a neighborhood, a previously white neighborhood, starts to integrate, even if individual whites don't have personal or psychological animosity or racial hatred, they still have an economic incentive to leave because they recognize that others might make the same calculation and leave first. So you get a vicious circle where whites calculate that other whites are going to sell when a neighborhood integrates. Therefore, they want to sell first to avoid losses, and they actually make it happen. They make white flight happen.
And if you think about African Americans, if African Americans are 20% of that market, it means that 80% of the people are not looking in those places for homes. So the prices of those homes declines or stays stable. And banks contribute to this by continually making loans in regions that are on the rise, white communities, and making it difficult to get loans in black communities.
So there's a difference. There's a lack of symmetry that's important to keep in mind. So it's not the same when whites are all by themselves. Because when they're all by themselves, they're taking all the resources with them. They're taking all the amenities with them. But when blacks are by themselves, they can't get loans. They don't have a decent tax base. There are no jobs. And then that becomes associated with black space.
In the end, what happened to Roosevelt happens in many neighborhoods when white families and businesses flee. The tax base eroded. Schools and services declined. The town was seen by county officials as a legitimate dumping ground for welfare families.
At one point, we had explicit laws that says whites are on top and blacks are on the bottom. Today, we have many of the same practices without the explicit language. And those practices are largely inscribed in geography. And so geography does the work of Jim Crow laws. So many people are confused. This, why after 50 years of civil rights are our schools still segregated? Why are our housing markets still segregated? Why are our jobs still segregated? And again, a lot of this is a function of how we've reinscribed the racial geographic space in the United States. That structure is still what we're living with today.
As homes in white communities appreciated in value, the net worth of these white families grew. For most non-white families who stayed in urban neighborhoods, the housing market open to them in the 50s and 60s was largely a rental market. You don't gain equity by paying rent.
Where one's family lives in America is not just a matter of taste and preference. You have the issue of housing and wealth. The majority of Americans hold most of their wealth in the form of home equity. So that's their nest egg. That's how they can finance the education of their offspring. That's how they can sort of save up for retirement. It's their savings bank, right? They're living in their savings bank.
My family, like a lot of families, was in Detroit struggling to buy a house. You had a dual housing market, one white, one black. A housing market with one with a lot of demand, another housing market with very little demand. My father lives in the house that I grew up in. The house today, five-bedroom house, is worth about $20,000. That same house bought in the suburbs would be worth today about $320,000. So whites moving to the suburb were being subsidized in the accumulation of wealth, while blacks were being divested.
And these were public policy decisions in which, on one hand, people were given access to property, given title, and subsequently wealth, and on another hand, where people were not given access to property, did not generate wealth, and did not generate the kind of opportunity for the next generation.
So if you can get a government loan, and with your GI Bill, your newly earned college degree, and buy a house in an all-white area that then appreciates in value, that then you can pass on to your children, then you're passing on wealth that has all been made more available to you as a consequence of racist policies and practices. To the child of that parent, it looks like my father worked hard, bought a house, passed his wealth on to me, made it possible for me to go to school, mortgaged that house so I could have, you know, relatively debt-free college experience and finance my college education. How come your father didn't do that? You know, well, there's some good reasons why maybe your father had a harder time doing it if you're African American or Latino or Native American.
And the thing that's really slick about whiteness, if you will, is that most of the benefits can be obtain without ever doing anything personally. For whites, they're getting the spoils of the racist system, even if they're not personally racist.
To glimpse one of the far-reaching consequences of racial inequality, you need only consider one statistic: comparative net worth or wealth. If you add up everything you own and subtract all your debts, what's left is your net worth.
Today, the average black family has only one-eighth the net worth or assets of the average white family. That difference has seemingly grown since the 1960s, since the civil rights triumphs, and is not explained by other factors like education, earnings rates, savings rates. It is really the legacy of racial inequality from generations past. No other measure captures the legacy, the sort of cumulative disadvantage of race.
a cumulative advantage of race for whites than net worth or wealth.
Even with the same income, white families have, on average, twice the wealth of black families. Much of that difference lies in the value of their homes. But what happens when we compare families along the color line who have similar wealth?
When you make the right comparison, when you compare a black kid from a family with the same income and wealth level as the white kid from the similar economic situation, rates of college graduation are the same. Rates of employment and work hours are the same. Rates of welfare usage are the same. So when we're talking about race in terms of a cultural accounting of these differences or a genetic accounting of these differences, we're really missing the picture because we're making the wrong comparison.
We want to be a colorblind society that values the content of character over the color of skin. The hope of thousands of newcomers who arrive each year is that we already are.
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic of which...
I don't see color. I see people, the saying goes.
There are people from 100 other nations who look different from you. People whose religion, history, skin color, and reason for being here today may be different from yours.
But in post-civil rights America, is color blindness the same as equality?
The notion of color blindness came to us from that famous I Have a Dream speech of Dr. Martin Luther King, where he said that people should be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of the skin. And what has happened in the post-civil rights era is that whites have assumed that we're already there, that we're in a society where color does not matter.
On the one hand, the civil rights era officially ended inequality of opportunity, officially ended de jure legal inequality. At the same time, those civil rights triumphs did nothing to address the underlying economic and social inequalities that had already been in place. It doesn't recognize the fact that the rewards, the house, the Lexus, the big bank account, those are not only the rewards of the pot of gold at the end of the game, they're also the starting position for the next generation.
The wealth gap grows. The advantages of being white accumulate from one generation to the next.
What are the benefits or the advantages to being white in a society that has historically given benefits and advantages to members of the dominant group? And if you are a person who has that privilege, you don't necessarily notice it.
So until we recognize that there's really no way to talk about equality of opportunity without talking about equality of condition, then we're stuck with this paradoxical idea of a colorblind society in a society that's totally unequal by color.
Claiming we don't see race won't end racial inequality. As Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun said, to get beyond racism, we must first take account of race. There is no other way.
And just as we're born into this system, we don't ask to be loaded up with stereotypes or omissions or distortions when we come into the world. We don't ask to be in a structure which is unfair, but that's what we have inherited. Whether you identify as a person of color, whether you identify as a white person, it doesn't matter.
I think we have to be uncomfortable with the present racial arrangement. In a sense, I think we have to be willing to be uncomfortable, willing to demand more of ourselves and more of our country, and willing to make the invisible visible.
I think we all have to think about, what can I influence? I don't influence everything, but the things I do influence, I can think about, how am I making this a more equitable environment? I can ask myself, who's included in this picture and who isn't? Who's had opportunities in my environment and who hasn't? What can I do about that?
All right. So that video is, I don't know if you've noticed the progression, but we talked about, which is kind of deliberate actually, we talked about individuals and our personal individual stories. And then we talked about our relationships with other people around us in this group and other groups that, you know, we have. And this video really highlights, okay, so we have stories, but there's a collective story we have as a country. And that's what we live in. And we have to take into consideration, like, what story are we living in that's the big one, you know, that influences us and has, I don't know, momentum in a particular direction. And so that's what that video was about. So typically, we have some response time for people. And I don't know if that is something that maybe we just do, go ahead and go into Q&A, and we can, you know, have that happening. So do you guys want to come on up, and maybe we can, like, just do a question and answer? So if you want to bring up maybe the lights, and then we can have a sense of, like, hey, we can see each other, that would be really great.
Why don't we just, like, set up a mic here, and people can just come up and ask a question?
So. Okay.
So if you have a question or a comment, this is the microphone.
Come on up and ask it or share what's on your mind.
What's the next step? Yeah. That's a great question. So what is the next step? What do we typically say, Jeff? We usually have a spiel for this.
Yeah. You know, the reason we end this class with that video, in some ways it's kind of a downer, because it's a kind of a bummer of a video. You kind of watch it and it feels like, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do about this? The big question is just whether or not you want to stay engaged in this stuff. Or whether we just want to pretend like it's not there. Because it's just easier to pretend it's not there. As far as, like, what can we do about it, you know, one of the biggest deals is to develop friendships and relationships with folks of other ethnicities and races. And sometimes people will say, it feels sort of artificial to have a goal of having friends of other races. That feels weird to me or something like that. What I've generally said is, listen, if you really would love to like go deeper in relationship with someone who's different from you, just start asking God to put someone in your life. And usually, if you start looking around at who's in your life, you'll discover there's some people who are different from you. Over time, as you develop trust, it's a really great thing to start to be able to ask people about what their experience is. Now, if you lead in with that before you've built a real relationship, it's just weird. Tell me about what it's like to be Chinese. Like, you know. But if you've built trust over time, and if when you ask, you're willing to listen, usually people kind of begin to open up a little more. I've discovered that with most of my friends who are people of color, there's a moment, maybe more than one, where they're talking about their experience and there's a little bit of pain and a little anger comes out. And I feel like at that moment, I'm on trial. The question is, can you handle this? Or are you going to interrogate me? Or are you going to shut down? Or are you going to disagree? And if I well, you know, you shouldn't be so mad. You know, he didn't mean to say that to you. It's, you know, you could see it differently. They just go like, yeah, not talking to you. But if in that moment I just get really quiet and I think I'm a little uncomfortable because you're angry and I don't know what to do with your anger, but I'm just going to listen. I'm going to sit here and just let you sort of actually, I find at that moment, that's like when trust starts to happen. That's then they're like, hey, I could actually talk to you, you know. I would say that if you have a friend who's a person of color, whoever like challenges you on your own racist attitudes, that is a treasure trove of gold. That is an amazing thing that you have. You know, don't argue. Don't say, I didn't mean to do it. Be like, this is amazing. Like, I'm getting a chance to go deeper into the experience of somebody that I, and this is like a gift that they're giving me to like be vulnerable, enter into this space. So the one next step I just say is just people developing relationships. That's a big deal. And the other one is just this thing of advocacy and like letting people roll their eyes at you. Just being the white person who will say, hey, how come all the speakers at the conference are white? Hey, like, how come all the pictures of all those people are white? How come, you know, should we say that? If we called this, you know, by this name, is that going to be offensive? And other people go, oh, more political correctness. Oh. But just be that person and don't worry about it.
The other practical thing is, if you remember that little worksheet, the interacting with others worksheet, it's on page 7. There's just like, you could even, if you're a person who is like, I have nobody, I have no circles in my life where it feels diverse and I don't know even where to start. That's actually that little list. If you just look through it, maybe pray over that and maybe God will highlight to you, hey, here's a way to do it. Why don't you go eat regularly at this restaurant and get to know the wait staff? Or why don't you go visit that store and just go back regularly and just like get into the vibe and the feel of that. But put yourself in places where, you know, there's opportunity to learn. And then from there, there could be potential connection.
Can I say one other thing? I have one other thing. I'm going to be a little bit controversial. I'm going to tell you what the next step isn't. Okay? The next step isn't go on a short-term missions trip. I'm going to be really honest. People who go on a lot of short-term missions trips, I often have hope that they're really going to be allies in this conversation, that they're going to go experience other cultures and come back and want to see reconciliation here. And I am so discouraged that it so rarely happens. It often seems like people who go on a lot of missions trips, it's almost like they get this false sense of confidence that they've experienced like other cultures and they know about other cultures, and they come back here and they just think they know everything, and it's really frustrating. I'm not saying short-term mission trips are like a bad thing. They're totally fine, but it's not the answer for reconciliation in the U.S. It just doesn't work. I don't know why.
I would say too, especially for the people who are in this room, who are taking in this information, and you're like a key leader in this church, I think one of the dangers in being at a big happening church like this is that you can never really get in touch with what it feels like to be other, you know, or one of something in a room. And so if you're not sensitive to what it would feel like to come as a person of color into a church this large, a room this large, and to have to wade through all the things that a person wades through as they come into a space where they're other, you know, where they're the other type of person, you won't really be sensitive to what you might have to tweak or what you might have to do or how you might have to become more welcoming to a person who's different. And I'll say from my own personal experience, as a pastor now, I realize that what I want a new person to do, what I want people that come to church, what I want them to do, I want them to connect with Jesus. I want them to connect with Jesus through the sermon, through the worship, and through the people. Seems simple enough. And when you walk into a space where everybody kind of looks like you, you just assume that there's all this shared understanding and identity. So you can connect with the message. You can connect with the humor in that message. You can connect with the stories and illustrations. The music is familiar. And you're not having to do a whole lot of wondering and processing about whether or not you belong here. Or when you're a person of color and you walk into a space like this, long before I can connect with the message, long before I can connect with the music, and certainly long before I can connect with the people, I'm wondering, am I welcome here? Where are all the people that look like me? I don't really jive with this music. The humor is, I get it, I understand it, but it's not really funny to me. I don't, those illustrations, that's not a dig against you, Michael, but the illustrations, I can understand them, but they are not relevant to my life. And so all the stuff that I'm supposed to connect with when I come to church, there are all these things that I need to jump over in order to get to Jesus. And frankly, you just don't have that much time. You know, you got one or maybe two visits for a new person to decide whether or not they're going to come back. And so all those things are working against a church that is predominantly white. And so if you, Michael, or Brenda, or your key leaders don't ever get into touch with what it feels like, the awkwardness and the insecurity that is involved in going to a space where you're, you know, you stand out and you don't have a whole lot of your cultural snacks there to feast on, you won't be sensitive to that as you set the culture for a place like this. Does that make sense what I'm saying? And so for those of you, I think everybody should be aware of that, but especially for those of you who set the culture and make the decisions about this place, you need to be regularly putting yourself in position where you deal with that awkwardness and where you're experiencing the difficulty of that so you can make some different decisions in how you create culture here.
I can just say a couple of things, and then probably like you or even Gino could speak to that too. One, white people can quit the conversation. That's the one thing I just say again and again. We can quit whenever, we can go as far and do it as feels comfortable and quit when we decide it's uncomfortable. That's really important to remember. Two, people of color who are involved in reconciliation, some, at first you think, I think, I'm such a nice white person. I care about you. Like, isn't that noble of me? And look, we're talking, it actually costs people of color something to be in this conversation. It costs like you and Gino to be something to be here. They're not net gaining from this. Do you follow me? They're net losing. And keeping that in my head, that I'm not doing Gino a favor by talking about reconciliation. He's doing me a favor, right? Those two things are the biggest things. I would just say, too, this is like a little dark. This race, the racial history of America, it's mind-blowing. Like, the rabbit hole doesn't end. Like, you go down this thing and just start studying the history of, like, white supremacy and oppression in America and what it has done and what the... I'm just warning you. It's really dark. You think it's this shallow little thing like Martin Luther King or something? It's like...
Okay, so having been his wife for a long time now, like I think what you're trying to look for maybe is like an arc of, if you're going to engage in this, what can you expect, right? I mean, that's... so it's like it's up and down. Like there was a while early in our marriage, we talked about this a lot. We engaged... Like when we got married, we said, hey, we understand we are from two different backgrounds and we just really want to press into that and understand that, and we know it's going to be hard. We did not know how hard it was going to be. And then for a while in our church, we tried to figure it out, but you know, our church was mostly white. And so we're like, okay, this is really frustrating, but what do we do? And then we're like, well, we have to come to the place where, you know, we must love the people that God brings to us, right? And so there's a matter of like, hey, we're really into this. Oh, we're really bummed out. Hey, we're really into this. Oh, we're really bummed out. Jeff went to it then, you know, a couple of years into it, Jeff went to a training done by the YWCA. And they're like all about diversity in Minneapolis, in St. Paul. And he came back and it broke him. Like it broke him in a way that was like, he was so despairing. I think we stopped doing anything related to diversity for like 3 years. Because it was just, that's how despairing it can feel. It's like, oh my gosh, I feel so powerless. And I want to say that feeling of powerlessness, it can be so overwhelming. The feeling of feeling powerless. You're like, I can't change the system. All the stuff they talked about with real estate practices, it's like, how in the world are we going to change that? And I think the thing of like being able to get back up from that feeling of powerlessness and really, and this is where I think the church is the hope of the world, because Jesus Christ is the hope of the world. We have to believe that there is something larger. There is something bigger. There is something to hope for, and that is the Christ. That is Christ. That is the power of the cross to bring reconciliation, to bring hope, to bring resurrection from death. Because that's what it feels like. It feels like death. Sometimes this conversation feels like death. So then you get back up, and you're like, okay, I'm going to keep going. And then it, you know, but it's always in an upward direction. It's like, you know, a sine wave in an upward trajectory. And for a person of privilege, I mean, it feels like 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. 2 steps forward, 1 step back. 2 steps forward, 3 steps back. And it just, it's slow and incremental, and you have to have faith because it's a lifelong journey. I mean, it took so many hundreds of years to, like, be in the situation we are now. Like, it's not going to just, you know, end overnight. And so I think that's, you know, but it's one of those things where I think the most incredible thing throughout this whole journey is the sweetness of Jesus in all of it. The incredible, like, if you want to have any kind of, if you have a robust theology of the incarnation and just meditate on the fact that God became human and made himself vulnerable as a child, as an infant, that he could have been harmed in so many ways, and he made himself vulnerable to us, screwed up humanity, and died for us. Like, it is so, so powerful and so hope-giving and life-giving in this very, very difficult conversation. And so that's one of those things where if you want to enter and engage in this, it is amazing. You will learn things about yourself and about God that you could never learn otherwise. You will discover more about what it means for the kingdom of God to win over the kingdom of darkness than in any other area that I have ever experienced. And it's incredible. But it's not simple. It's not, you know, it's the feeling, like, you really feel like you are waging a battle. I mean, if you want to feel like you are in the army of God, this is what it is like. This is a war that we are fighting. And I fully intend to be on the front lines, and we're going to win because we have Jesus Christ.
Preach it, girl.
I think if you're asking yourself, how do I know that I'm in the fight? How do I know if I'm doing this right? I think a sure sign that you're engaging this is that it's costing you something. You can't do this right without it costing you something. And whether you're white with power and privilege, or you're a person of color and you're engaging, if you're doing this right, it's going to cost you something. And as a movement, it's going to cost us something in order to engage this. You know, when we took a stand on women's issues, you know, people walked away from the movement. They said, this isn't what I signed up for. This is what we believe. And the movement was comfortable. I shouldn't say comfortable. They were okay with those people saying, we need to go. And so if you talk to people like Rich, who have transitioned churches and who decided that it was a kingdom ideal that he was going to pursue to change things and to fix the hiring practices in his church and to look at the music and look at the culture of his church, Rich will tell you that people left. People said, this isn't the church that I fell in love with. This isn't who we want to be, and that's fine. But the sure sign for leadership, and even just people in their everyday lives with their relationships, if this isn't costing you anything, if you're not finding that you're having to surrender some of your comforts, you're having to go to some uncomfortable places, you're having to have difficult conversations, if it's not costing you something, then you're probably not doing this right. What do you mean?
Well, like, you want to meet more people of diversity, say they're not in your neighborhood, or wouldn't it be strange for, like, the two of us just on a given Sunday going to a church that's all black? Would be, you know, would they also maybe struggle with that because more of their culture is, you know, they're all black and we're not? Are there assumptions made? Or?
Well, I think you should go and find out. I think the short answer is yes. But it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. And you're trying to understand what it means for a person of color to walk in here. But I can tell you, as a product of the black church, there's a lot of cultural richness and sweetness and a lot of sweet Holy Spirit there. And so you might like it. You might like it. But I think that that's fantastic. And frankly, they need to experience you because they probably don't have a lot of people like you walking in on Sunday morning. And so I think that would be great. Will it feel weird? Will it feel strange? Will you probably not know what to do right away or for the first few months? Probably. But I think that that's what we're asking each other to do, is to tear down some of these walls and to be willing to be uncomfortable. So try it.
Yeah, I could just say a couple of things. Just to if you go to Black Church, probably dress up, probably bring something for the offering. I'm just practical. I just think that would be like polite. Just that's what in most black churches I know about, that's what would be expected of a black visitor, would be that they would probably bring something for the offering. They'd probably dress nicely. So that's just a hot.
You can disagree. I kind of disagree, because if I just want people to be themselves, you know. And so, again, I grew up in a black church, and yet there's an expectation that people who are, you know, familiar with that culture would dress up. But I don't think you have to necessarily become something that you're not in order to do that. I mean, when I go to churches where I know that's the custom, I do out of respect. But I don't know if I would expect somebody from a different culture to do that. Again, I'm trying to remove barriers rather than put ones in place. And so that's just kind of a place where Jeff and I might disagree a little bit.
Dress up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's ask this. Who's been to the AME church in Duluth? Who dressed up? I'd like to speak to it just because I've been there a couple times. And I'm with Gina. I just went like I was. And was it uncomfortable in certain ways? Sure. Were there people that gave me a funny look and people that welcomed me with open arms? Yes, both. Fair enough, but I wasn't the only white person there either.
No, you're not. St. Mark's African Episcopal Church is about halfway.
Yeah. I would really, as Gina said, I'd really encourage you to do this, to actually go. And I would also follow up on what was said, but bring something for the offering, because when I was there, they took three offerings. And it's just a reality. It's so healthy to see it through a different set of eyes, to see how people do church in a different way, and to get to know some people. And if you're lucky, there's a meal afterwards that you can join them downstairs for.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really awesome is I think they will love you however you come. I mean, they're like our brothers and sisters in Christ. That's what I've experienced, at least in the past, right? And so I think if you, whatever you choose, I'm a big fan of like trying to learn to fit contextually into where I'm going. And so I think that's a value for me. That's a personal value for me. But they will, I mean, they have the heart to like love the church. So they will love you, I think. Yeah.
This question is for Jeff. Well, it's for all of you.
Yeah.
But, as a woman of what you would consider color, why do I feel offended when you say a person of color? And why do I think it's more of a disability, or you make it feel like a disability? And why do you judge, like, I'm East Indian, I'm not even black, and I get called nigger, and my son gets called nigger because he's half black?
Why do I use the term person of color? Well, typically people have used the term minority a lot to refer to folks who are not white. But in America, it's becoming the case that
people of color aren't minorities because they're going to be the majority of the color country by like 2040. In some ways, I understand being offended by that phrase. It's what most of my friends who aren't white have told me that they, it's the term that others have told me they prefer I say. If I were to be asked to use a different term, I would be willing to use it. You know, in a lot of ways, I mean, race really is sort of a fictional construct, but it's a construct that has impact. And so I feel like we do need to talk about it. And if I've used that word in a way that's offensive to you, I'm really, really sorry. I didn't intend to, but...
Terminology is tricky. Language is it's a deal. I mean, and this one is not a simple one because everybody has a different opinion about and a different response to language and what language they prefer or don't prefer, you know? And so this one is just the thing of, I think if we would just be willing to engage with each other and not chicken out, even if we use the wrong words, but then like what Jeff was saying of like really focus on the impact of what words we do use and what that has done to another person, because there's a history there, there's a story there, and that's what we're really wanting to uncover is like, you know, if Stacey was hurt by a term that I used, I want to know and I want to bring healing in our relationship, and how can we do that? And I'm not worried. I mean, I am worried, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't want to focus on the words because our words will come out, like what comes out of our heart. Like, that's what matters, you know? And phrase to phrase, I've just found phrase to phrase, it's like as many people as there are is as many words as are wrong or right. That's just what I've discovered.
Is that your name, Stacey? Yeah. I'd like to meet you sometime. I just want to make a comment, actually, on that. You know, my family and I, we've lived kind of all over. My boys were born in Chicago. And we spent a year down in Atlanta, and my kids generally grew up here. And they're, you know, they're half black, and they look more black than some people with two black parents. And we get down, so they essentially grew up in a white community, you know, and not really knowing any difference because whatever, they were whatever. And a few years ago, we spent a year down in Atlanta, and we got down there, and it was a huge culture shock. Because these kids who grew up, you know, around here, and now they're on the football team, and they came home from the first day of football, and they were like, eyes this big, and they were like, oh my God, I'm like, what happened? And it was just months of learning and trying to educate my white woman trying to educate my kids on, you know, how to navigate this. But that specific term of color is very interesting because down in Atlanta, my kids went to the highest top-end prep school, college. I mean, $35,000 a year. It was insane. When you talk about privilege, didn't matter what color you were, that was privilege, and I got schooled. And the admissions gal was a black gal. And I remember going in there and saying, you know, hey, Marcy, I don't know how to do this. You know, what do we need to do? And I used that term color. And she said, what? And I said, did I say something wrong? You know, I'm like, what did I say? And I told him, like, hey, educate me. And she schooled me on the different areas. She's like, you don't say color, you say black. And I say, okay, so, you know, do I say a black woman? Yes, but never say educated black. And this and that. She went on and on and on and on. And I felt I was just in a sea of confusion. And it was just being sensitive to a term, to say, you know, what would you prefer? But even the areas within the United States, you can say our country has so much heritage, and yes, Jeff, you know, you look through each little rabbit hole and you're like, dear God, what am I gonna find? But then it's always, you know, what now? You know? And so anyway, I just, experiencing Atlanta and experiencing the South, which I never grew up in the South, I didn't have a lot of experience with the South. Chicago was totally different. But that word colored meant something totally different. And they said, no, ethnic. You know, ethnic. Just any ethnicity. I'm thinking, well, I'm German, you know, so I'm ethnic too. But So I don't know if there's any point in that, but that colored and... Sorry, Stacy.
That's good. Well, we need to move into ministry time. And so let's all stand up. And I'll get us started with some stuff, and then you guys feel free to weigh in. And I think we've just barely begun to scratch the surface of a really good conversation that we need to continue to have. I've seen a couple ads. I don't know if they're on the screen or just in the restrooms for a what do we call it? A fireside chat? A fireside chat coming up in May to continue this conversation with a couple of voices that we heard here, and we're just gonna keep doing it. We're gonna keep pressing in and learning and growing. Oh, and then the November conference in Chicago. Gino, you're leading that. You're like in charge of that thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a bunch of us are going down to that at the Evanston Vineyard. Yep. And so, yeah, we have information about that. That's on the screen right there. The speaker lineup, Jeff says, is incredible. That's awesome. I'm excited. So a bunch of us are heading down to that. You're welcome to come. By then, the snow will be back. Here's a few things for prayer. First of all... I think for some of us, there's repentance as God is uncovering racism that we didn't know we had. And so for some of us, God's, I think, inviting us into repentance for stuff that we didn't know we had in us. And there's kind of a tug. You feel a tug towards that, maybe even a bit of a sting that that's going on. And then I've had several conversations with people who look like me saying, this is good, this is good. What do we do? What do we do? And so I think for some of us, we need the Holy Spirit to come empower us to listen and to stay engaged and to push that question back a little bit further. Because according to Jeff, and I tend to believe him, that's just part of our culture. For some of us, we might be feeling angry. Just kind of unexplained anger coming up. Or there's the guilt that we talked about that I think God wants to come and bring some healing to. Especially if you're here and you feel extra vulnerable now that the conversation has started. I think God wants to meet you. He wants to do some stuff. And so if those things speak to you, would you just come right up in the front right now? And then I'm going to pass the mic down the row here. And if there's some other stuff that you feel like God's dialing up, just share it and let's begin to pray for one another.
Another thing is the feeling of shame. This conversation, because it touches on our identity, it often wells up this sense of shame, that we feel ashamed of who we are, whether we are, whatever our skin color, whatever our background, whatever, like, there's a sense of shame sometimes that comes up and we struggle with it. And so if that's something that you are feeling and it's just unsettled in your stomach, that is something the enemy brings to divide us, and to keep us away from each other, to keep us, you know, running from each other or running from others. And I just want to break that off and pray that that place where it's coming from would be healed, if that's something that you're struggling with.
I wasn't going to say anything, but then something just hit me really hard. I think there's a few of you, this may not be something you want to deal with publicly, Michael, you talk about repentance for maybe some racism we didn't know about. I think some people in here might have some really dark racial pasts. I kind of felt it and I felt kind of sick, almost feel like throwing up. Like you were involved in some maybe like racial violence or like maybe even like a member of the Klan or something. I felt this really sick thing of like, and you may now not feel that way, but if that's in your past, I mean, I think there's probably demonic stuff tied up with that.
And it could even be just a father or grandfather that was in the Ku Klux Klan or some Mason stuff or So it could be just in your generations back, so you don't practice that, but you don't like that it's in your heritage, and that would be really good just to pray over you, because anything generational, we can say, this is it, this is the end of the line. I break that now. This is where it stops. So I think that's important. So why don't you guys just respond to that? Come on down, just any of those things. Just come on up. If you are not getting prayer and you're on the prayer team, come on up here, please. As we do traditionally. And I think that we should all leave with a touch from Jesus today on this momentous day for us as a church. So anything that God was doing in you over the last couple days that you just want him to continue, we want to pray for that. So feel free to come now, and we'll worship for a couple of songs, and we'll have like a facility team that'll be coming through in the next like 20 or so minutes, so we're not going to belabor this for a long time, but we have some time to still pray for each other and just do what God's doing. Father, I thank you for this journey that we're on and the impact of the last 24 hours on our spirits. And God, I ask you keep stirring us up. And I ask the seeds that are planted would just grow and be fertilized. And Father, that you would take us to new places that we haven't gone with you yet. And I thank you for the things you've invited us into, the ideas you've given us, the people that will sit at our table that maybe wouldn't have before today. And we say, yes, Lord. We say, yes, Lord, do it. Do it all, God. We give you ourselves and our lives and our purpose to be spent how you want to spend us, Father, for others. Let's pray for each other and worship. Just feel free to come on up and get some ministry.